Bose-Einstein condensation has this very long history, long before this picture became famous. I think probably the first example of this these folks here. this is the true ground state.
But they're not identical.
Multi-components. what I wanted to do here was just review some of the places where Bose-Einstein condensation has been important in other places. For example, liquid helium, excitons, and semiconductors. I will not talk about trapped bosonic atoms since you know all about that. In nuclear matter, they've become important in my one foray into quantum electronics. Pi meson condensation, K meson condensation, where these are bosonic mesons, which through Bose condense in nuclear matter. And also, the notion of Bose-Einstein condensation has become very important in field theory, understanding the vacuum and the early universe. I just want to say a few words about different places where one sees Bose-Einstein condensation in the vacuum. Now, I also mentioned other down here. The most beautiful example, I think, was Mark Edwards' lovely thing on the web of Bose-Einstein statistics and the movies, which I guess the basic idea here was stimulated attendance. You know, if a few people go, then it becomes very popular, other people go. And, so somebody from the University of California has written a learned paper on the subject. Somewhat more seriously was Roger Penrose's great comment here, that a strong proponent of the idea that Bose-Einstein condensation may provide a unitary sense of self that seems to be characteristic of consciousness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it had applications of biology as well. Now, after the initial discovery by Einstein, initial proposal by Einstein and of Bose condensation, the first realization, as we know, was liquid helium, 1938, where Fritz London realized that the lambda point of helium looked remarkably like the experimental lambda point of helium looked remarkably like the specific heat singularity in the ideal Bose gas. And he remarked that it seems difficult not to imagine a connection with the condensation phenomenon of Bose-Einstein statistics. And this was really the beginning. Since that time, there's been a lot of work trying to understand what the size of the number of particles that are condensed in helium, and also whether it has anything whatsoever to do with Bose-Einstein condensation. There's long arguments with Landau about Landau absolutely didn't believe it. He thought the interactions were exceedingly important, which of course they were. But there have been measurements in recent years, first through neutron scattering, of the measure the condensate fraction. And shown in the bottom picture here is something in the order of 10% of the atoms at zero pressure are in lowest mode dropping. These measurements are done by neutron scattering, and for various technical reasons, they're not very good. There's very, very large error bars. The dotted lines here are Green's function Monte Carlo calculations done by David Sepperly at Illinois, which are very consistent with the estimates with the measurements here. Recently, a very beautiful paper was published in Nature. Where's our Nature lady? The New Year's Day issue of Nature, where Wyatt has done a very simple experiment, namely taking a beam of phonons and trying to knock particles out of helium. If you remember that the phonon spectrum, energy versus momentum, comes up and dips down, and this phonon energy now, what he sees is, imagine that the surface had no effect. Then a phonon coming along would hit an atom, and if the atom has zero momentum, the phonon it would get ejected with the momentum of the phonon, and then you'd get a very sharp peak. However, the surface of the helium, momentum is not conserved in the vertical direction across the surface. And so there's a slight distortion of this peak. And so what is found here as a function of the angular distribution of the emerging helium atoms, a very sharp peak, which is indicative of the fact that there's a Boltzmann zero momentum state. What is shown in the inset here is the momentum distribution of the particle, of the excited particles, and that would give rise to a much broader peak here. So this is actually very nice evidence for the existence of F condensation, a rather simple experiment. Yeah. Actually, the 8% number that I showed was predicted very early by Penrose. This is the other Penrose and Unsauger in 1956, where they estimated something in the order of 8% of the atoms should be in the condensed, in the zero momentum state. Another very important notion that came through Penrose and Unsauger in helium was the idea of the order parameter, namely that in a condensate, if one has both condensation, if you look at psi and psi dagger and separate, you try and remove a part that r prime and in fact at r, then it, as this point becomes very far separated, the system has not, in a normal system, this goes to zero. In a Bose-Einstein condensate, a uniform one, it will go to some constant value, which is the basically the order parameter of the system. Now, I mentioned, you're all familiar with this, but I mention this because this notion of the order parameter has become exceedingly important in discussing broken symmetry situations in high energy physics. One important question one can ask is whether superconductivity really should be thought of as a Bose-Einstein condensation. The BCS theory, that one has the simple wave function here, where you add pairs of particles to the vacuum to build up the paired state. And there's an order parameter, which is just the amplitude for removing a particle spin up and a particle spin down at the same point, going back to the same state. Now, there's a very important difference between Bose condensation and BCS, which is that here the pairs are very large compared to the interatomic spacing. This is really a condensation of momentum space. The correlation is scaled, you know, in a normal superconductor over some 10 to the 4th angstroms as opposed to inter-electron spacing, which is more comparable to 1 in 10 angstroms, fewer than 10. The other important difference is that when pairing occurs here, the system Bose condenses. The system condenses and goes into the superconductor state right away. There's the earlier theory, contemporaneous with BCS, of Shaffer, Butler, and Black. And they have the picture that the interactions would form pseudo molecules, electron molecules, pairs of electrons, above the Fermi surface, and that these would both condense. Now, this picture of. In a picture like this, the place where the pairing occurs doesn't have to be the condensation point. I mean, you sketched a picture here. If you look at temperature versus density, then in their model, one comes down, you begin to form molecules, and then they both condense. You come down over here. Whereas in BCS, you go straight from the Fermi gas straight into the superconducting state. By looking at changing the density of the BCS wave function, sweep out this entire space over here. But the point is that the ordinary superconductivity, as we know it in metal, is qualitatively quite different from the Bose-Einstein condensation. I mean, a simple example is if you begin, for example, with gas deuterons, which are fermions, then as you cool down, they form molecules at some point, which are Bose-Einstein. And you cool further, which I hope somebody will do, you then can begin to make Bose-Einstein condensation. But it's qualitatively different from the The second interesting system, which we've talked about before in other places, has been the Bose-Einstein condensation of para-exicons in Cooper's oxide, which began, this work began in the late 80s by Wolf, Mizurovich, and his students, where you take a laser, a green laser obviously, shine it on a piece of Cooper's oxide, and then this produces excitons, which are basically hydrogen atoms of electrons and holes. Now, what's nice about the system is that there are, the excitons are not long-lived. There are two kinds. There's the orthoexitons, which have angular momentum 1, which live on the order of tens of nanoseconds. The para-excitons, angular momentum 0, which live more on the order of tens of microseconds. Now, as these things de-excite, they emit light. And so you can actually, just by looking at the luminescence, you can see the, you can actually physically see, measure the distribution of particles. And this is a typical spectrum of energy versus intensity versus energy. One can fit chemical potentials to these are very nicely fit by Fermi Dirac, by Bose-Einstein distributions, from which you deduce a chemical potential temperature and density temperature. And there was a very interesting phenomenon that came out of this, which was that at temperature versus density, it appears that the excitons rode along a line just above the critical density of condensation. They didn't want it. This was something of a great mystery. There are very learned discussions, for example, Nozier had a suggestion of internal Josephson effect between power and ortho excitons and stuff. But it was actually very nicely explained by George Kavalakis here. Let me just remark what happens there. In the system, this shows the what was done was to apply stress to the system. The stress separated the para and ortho excitons and made it possible to measure both. And so this intensity of these are the laser pulse that starts the system to a nanosecond time scale. This is the ortho excitons dying away and the para excitons, which live much longer. This signal is amplified by a factor of 500, as you can see it here. Now on this picture, what you see then is that the ortho excitons live just above this line over here. The paras actually do cross in and do become those condensed. The explanation of why the orthos want to live above here is very pretty. I'll just briefly review that. Which is that the critical line for Bose-Einstein condensation is an adiabatic. It has an entropy of the order of 2.5 units of entropy per particle. It appears that the orthos want to live on a line slightly above this. So then this is just a natural thing to do, is to look at the entropy of the orthos as a function of time. Then there are really two competing processes. The lattice is very cold compared to the exciton cloud that's created. And so when it's photon cooling, which goes roughly as temperature to 3.5 Kelvin, on the other hand, there's this Auger heating process in which pairs of excitons will pairs of excitons will interact. For example, the electron of one will drop into a hole in the other, and a very energetic pair of electron and hole will be ejected. And these electrons and holes eventually come back and reheat the exciton gas to a certain extent. The result of this is that there's a heating process which is proportional to the density of ortho excitons. And you ask, well, where does this thing vanish? It vanishes on a line where the density goes to temperature to 3.5, which is precisely an adiabatic. So the system actually has there's a fixed point adiabatic in the system where the ortho excitons will have to go. And one has a rather rapid approach there on a time on the order of 25 picoseconds, which is unfortunately too rapid to resolve this one. So what you find is the orthos do go along here. But the paras, this process, for rather technical band theory reasons, which the orthos, it's expected for ortho-ortho collisions, ortho-para collisions, but not para-para. And so once the orthos decay, the paras can no longer do this, and then they sail right down into the condensed region. So here's a nice system waiting to be studied. Unfortunately, not terribly much has happened here. And there are many interesting questions one would like to understand. For example, are there possible states of superfluidity?
Can you this cloud of exciton is made? Here's
a real photograph of the exciton cloud. I mean, just from luminescence. It's spread out.
Can one really study the coherence of these clouds and does exist superfluid behavior? Are there other nice tricks that we've seen in atomic systems? And so one reason for mentioning this is I hope some people might actually want to start thinking about these questions.
There was a rather intriguing experiment done by Nizarovich, in which, for some reason, his lasers come from the right, not from the left.
What he does is shines a pulse laser on Cooper's oxide, and then measures the propagation of the cloud of excitons. What he finds is that at low temperatures, it propagates with a velocity which is essentially the sound velocity of Cooper's oxide. Now, the interesting question here is one really seeing a ballistic propagation of superfluid through the system here, or whether this is possibly just being driven by a photon wind? I think it's very interesting. He also has some very nice results on looking at stimulated emission of excitons as this cloud goes along. What he does is shine, as the cloud propagates, he shines a CW laser from the bottom, which stimulates growth of excitons into the cloud here. And so what you see is this is propagating across with pulse arrives. Then he turns on the CW laser and pulse this figure here. And there's actually a gain that's proportional to the strength of the CW laser. This is a brighter laser, a brighter CW laser. No, this is considered evidence of stimulated emission. The question is whether one is near forming an excitonic laser. I don't know.
But there are certainly possibilities. I don't know the answer, so why do you please comment?
No, because it's like the old calculation shows that it's induced if you have some flow and from this side, it's induced typical Bohr behavior.
Oh, no, that
nothing to do with superfluidity.
That you get stimulation here, yes.
That's
not your superfluidity. Yeah. That you have clouds propagating ballistically, isn't it? That's
interesting question. I did a calculation in Sweden a long time ago. Just trying to understand the growth of the width of these clouds. Putting in basically phenomenological scraping of the friction with the cloud against the substrate. And for the weak excitations, one finds this is cloud width versus time. For weak laser excitations, one finds that the cloud growth there appears to be scattering against the substrate. However, for large laser excitation back here, it appears to be frictionless flow. But I think these are things that need to be done much more carefully to understand if these things are superfluid, how do they actually propagate the system? Okay. At this stage, One point I wanted to make about the excitonic systems.
They're different from the atomic systems in a very important way, and it's the same is true of the nuclear system, which is there's a very strong interplay between the boson and the fermion degrees of freedom. There are in the exciton system, there are electrons and holes. In the nuclear system, there are nucleons. And they play a very, very important role in determining properties of the system.
I just want briefly to in one view graph, just to comment on condensates in the vacuum.
This condensate has become very important since probably the 60s. First of all, we recognize the existence of chiral condensates. The strong interactions have a SU3 cross SU3 symmetry, which is seen in the conservation of the helicity, the spin of a massless particle. As it moves along, you can't flip, the interactions cannot flip the spin. That's with chiral condensation. This is seen in low energy phenomena, sort of physics is less than the GED. And the important evidence is really that the mass of the pi meson is very, very small, it's a gold boson of this growth symmetry. And so the vacuum is filled with condensate.
The vacuum is filled with a Q quark anti quark pair, up quark anti up quark, down anti down, strange anti strange. What is the fundamental boson associated with this? I don't know whether there really is one or whether really is a composite system. David? Huh? No. I mean, but I mean, the go, but not the Q bar Q, that's the sigma. There are such things, but they're iffy. It's very nice to think in terms of this with a.
This is the very, very pretty model, the sigma model, where you can just think what's happening is the vacuum lives in the bottom of the wine bottle. Again, the ground state. And one has a symmetry, which is rotation about the bottle of the wine bottle, about the bottom of the wine bottle. And then the normal world lives at some point here because the
symmetry is not quite exact, but with the filter.
And it lives over here, at this point over here, where this is the breaking of the symmetry. Then the evidence of this symmetry is the fact that the excitation, the rolling of the ball around the wine bottle, has a very, very low energy, that's the mass of the pion, which is very small compared to the mass of the nucleus.
Interesting thing here is that as one heats the system,
if you think again the ball in the wine bottle, at high enough temperature, you get a restoration of the symmetry, and the ball just bounces around on average along the axis.
Now, one of the interesting questions is can one in fact study such a Bose-Einstein
decondensation experimentally?
And the answer is yes, and we're spending, I would say, well over $1 billion to do this. This is a rough phase diagram of nuclear matter versus density.
The equilibrated nuclear matter, on temperature vertically and density here. And so the vacuum really goes along here. Now, at low density, the important degrees of freedom are hadrons, baryons, mesons. When you go to very high densities, or high temperatures, then the quarks that make up these objects themselves become the important degrees of freedom. And the transition between these two regions is really one where the chiral symmetry becomes restored. And so here one has this broken chiral symmetry, and this region at much higher densities and temperatures, unbroken. And so the question is, can one go about studying this?
And one can do this in actually collisions of very ultra-relativistic ions. This is the same picture here. Next year, RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider of Brookhaven, will slam together very large pieces of gold-on-gold nuclei at 100 GeV per particle. It's 100, rest mass 100 times.
I mean, kinetic energy 100 times or less. The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, will do a similar thing starting in the year 2010. N is on the order of 5 with the fluctuation. So what happens here is that one takes these two nuclei, slams them together. They pass through each other, but the vacuum in between gets very strongly heated, and you can't go up into this place where Bose-Einstein. The condensation is destroyed. The Bose-Einstein decondensation. Then there's some interesting questions as the gas cools back down, whether you can actually, do you actually come back to the same Bose-Einstein condensed state you had before, or can you, for a while, have some anomalous states? So we're in this SU3 picture, at the bottom of the wine bottle, you recondense in states that aren't in the ideal vacuum, but it's somewhat different. This would show up. As this state reconverts back into pi mesons, with unusual statistics of the pi produced. So this will really
take place.
I don't understand. You think that it will be overcome constraint?
That will?
Will be overcome constraint? When you tell about particles above for very large temperature events. You think that there will be no constraint?
Constraint from what?
When we have the usual baryon or something like that, we have constraint and possibility to go away quark. Yes? Not able to.
The initial baryon, you need to confine it.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, one will get to energy densities of several GeV per cubic Fermi,
yes,
which are way more than should be enough. I won't say more than enough; they should be enough. I mean, the original baryons here are rather unimportant. I mean, you'll make on the order of 10,000 pi meson. Is that they themselves will not be boson friendly? Yes, the entropy is simply too high here.
I just want to come back again to this question of condensates in the vacuum. There is the question,
one of the most famous Bose-Einstein condensates in the vacuum is the Higgs metal, which is responsible for producing the masses. Here, most likely, this is a fundamental meson, may not be. And the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature is about 150 GeV, and that means in the early universe, up to a time of around a picosecond, the system was Bose-Einstein decondensed, and then the electron weak transition was essentially a main condensation. And this meson is, of course, very important because all the masses of the elementary particles, of course, mesons and such, are proportional to the order parameter, the expectation value of the case in the vacuum.
Last night, David Gross, the director of this institute, pointed out the ultimate Bose-Einstein condensation, which is the graviton condensation,
which we all, the order parameter is very simple. I mean, you know, when you do relativity, you know about x squared minus t squared. There's a metric, minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And this in fact, is the order parameter for the graviton condensation.
I will let you discuss this in more detail with David later. The next topic I want to discuss is that of pion condensates in matter.
Now, this is also an old Santa Barbara problem. I guess it began in two ways. One, Kajum Migdal in Moscow, and also quite just about the same time, Ray Sawyer was here, Doug Scalapino in Santa Barbara, also proposed this as an interesting system. The question is, if you take very dense matter, for example, neutron-rich matter, we have a large, as in neutron stars, well above nuclear matter mass. If you have neutrons, protons, and electrons, Fermi sieve, if the Fermi energy of the neutron gets high enough compared to the proton, the neutron can change into a proton plus a pi minus, which is very loud. And this will occur when the energy difference is bigger than the rest energy, rest mass of the pi meson, which is actually plus interaction. Now, the interaction effects, there's a very attractive interaction between the pions and the nucleons, which cause the effective energy of a pi meson in the matter to be depressed. And so this makes condensation occur much earlier than before you see the full mass of the pi meson at 40 million volts. There's an attractive P wave interaction as an interaction of gradient of the pion, which is gradient of the order parameter, with the nucleon spin. Now, in order to take advantage of this interaction, it's necessary that the pion field not be uniform, but actually have spatial variation. And so what we find is that the critical density should be something on the order of twice the nuclear matter density, and which in people's units is in the order of 10 to 38 particles per cubic centimeter, which means nothing. And what one gets the Bose-Einstein condensate of negative mesons, with an order parameter that will vary e to the ik dot r, really a plane wave on the system. And because it's a charged field, this system is just really a super. It's rather hard to do
Josephson experiments and such on it, but it should be superconductor. What's happening in the vacuum, and again, coming back to the bottom of the wine bottle, is instead of sitting right at the vacuum state over here, you rotate off in the direction of the pion.
The new state system.
It's a very strange state. Again, this is a system where the fermion eigenstate, fermion states couple in very important ways.
The nucleon eigenstates become actually rotated in space. I mean, you may ask the question, if you started with pure neutron matter, how can you form a negative charge system? You have to get positive charge somewhere. You get a proton, but the actual eigenstates of the system turn out to be linear combinations of neutrons and protons. It's a strange situation.
Now, this is very nice and academic, but it actually has a very important implication, and may in fact be experimentally detectable. I'll come back to that in a moment. But the point is that in neutron stars, such a process is really very important for cooling of neutron stars, if this condensate exists. Because a proton could go along, or sort of pseudo-proton, scatter from this pion field, become a neutron, which then beta decays to a proton emitting an electron neutrino. The neutrino leaves and carries away energy entropy. Now, I should say that to date there's no evidence of such a phenomenon in laboratory nuclei. People search it. It probably is forbidden by various interaction facts.
Another version of this. I should point out that Ray Sawyer gave me a whole sheet of calculations today, arguing very, very strongly for this thing occurring in not too much above nuclear matter density. What is your favorite density?
No, my argument was the condition of that remarkable tender bend that you get in neutral plan.
Yeah.
It's some population. And my study is neutral at one density.
Okay, you can't say that because they don't know what neutral is yet. This is neutral. Okay. Yeah. I mean, these are calculations that need doing. And there's another version, which is neutron goes to neutron plus neutral pi meson, proton to proton plus neutral pi meson. And obviously, this is a form of soft mode instability, since it cannot take place unless the energy of the pi meson goes to zero. So what the interaction will do is drive the energy of the meson down at some finite wave vector here, giving rise to a field in the system that will have some plane wave, or real plane wave behavior. And these are some one would end up in the matter with a these example pure neutron matter, essentially an array of neutron spins which flip over, basically an antiferromagnetic type of arrangement. In symmetric nuclear matter, where with neutrons and protons, one could have various other configurations. But it would show, again, in the fermions, and some spin order there. These are questions one is learning about. We're still learning about, because we don't know the interactions in nuclear matter.
The interactions between nucleons vary very well. These are recent calculations done by a student of Vijay Pandurpanda Nirvana, Arya Akmal. Where what he finds is looking at the energy per particle increasing density, so ordinary nuclear matter is here. As he goes up, he finds this other state, which appears to have the spin ordering at a somewhat lower density. And so these are calculations that need improving to be able to understand better whether this really is a possible state.
I just mentioned just very, very briefly, because you're all getting worn out. The possibility of K-meson condensation.
K-meson is made of strange and an up quark. And again, strong interactions in nuclear matter between the K-ons and the nucleons can tend to lower the energy of the K-meson. And again, one can begin to form a condensate of K-meson, which would also have important effects on cooling of neutron stars.
These are very, very model-dependent things. And, should not be taken 100% seriously. Now let me just quote, since time is ticking on, talk about how would you go about observing these things in neutron stars. This is a picture of a neutron star. This is the experimental cell.
Neutron stars being about 10 kilometers across, weighs about the same as the sun, 1.4 solar mass. As you go deep into the interior, there's a crust, and then there's a liquid, neutrons, protons, and the inner core may contain these various meson. And the question is, can you see them?
This is the diagram of the experimental cell. This is an actual photograph of the experimental cell object.
This is actually the crab nebula. That's a real neutron star, 10 kilometers.
Now, the question is,
cooling of neutron stars. Neutron stars cool in time. And in the early stages, they cool by emitting neutrinos.
And the question is, does Bose-Einstein condensation affect this cooling of neutrinos?
So there's basically the basic issue in the cooling is there's this very hot core. The outer region is basically just a thermal blanket. But the important processes in the early first million years of the star are to have neutrinos from the core to just pass it straight out. Eventually, ordinary surface radiation becomes important. Now, the typical process
that cools stars is neutrinos.
Neutrinos, neutrons by the protons, electrons, neutrinos, electrons absorbing protons, emitting neutrinos. And each time the neutrinos leave, they carry away energy and momentum. This is called the Urquhart process after the gambling casino in Rio, because every time the process happens, the bank takes its cut. Now, it turns out for technical reasons and corresponding energy and momentum conservation, this appears not to work at low momentum. It doesn't work in low momentum fractions. You can't conserve energy and momentum simultaneously. And so what you need is to have an extra nucleon around, a bystander nucleon, and now you can conserve energy and momentum. The price you pay for having a extra degenerate particle is that the density of states are reduced by Pauli. And so this process is greatly slowed down. Now, the place the Bose-Einstein condensates come in is, as I mentioned, that if you, for example, have pion condensation, you get this process where a neutron can beta decay into itself, effectively. Mixed neutron protons can beta decay into themselves. In a sense, it's like a Bragg scattering of the nucleon off the pion field, which provides the extra momentum. Remember, this pion field is a nucleon. And the result of this is that one gets a much more rapid cooling of the star. Similarly, with KM condensation, one would also get a more rapid cooling of the star. And so you could put this to an experimental test. And this picture here shows if you just had any one process operating as a function of time, what the temperature versus time would be for a star. The ordinary modified Urquhart cools very slowly here. Pion condensation would give rise to extremely cold stars. Photon emission from the surface kicks in only much later. It's importantly much later. And so what's shown down here, schematically, is just temperature versus time, that if the ordinary cooling processes, which are the ordinary nucleon beta decays and photon cooling, would give rise to something in this region here, or the yellow region here. But if these other, things like pion condensation, KM condensation are important, they would give accelerated cooling at the time of 100 years. So one can really begin to look and ask the question, do stars cool more rapidly? Well, of course, it's very hard to take a neutron star and just sit there taking its temperature over hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years. What you do is you look in the sky and you take a survey of various stars. And this is almost a cartoon, really, of temperature versus age. And you really measure luminosity, you don't know you're really measuring the surface temperature. These are X-ray satellites, the measurements. Improved X-ray satellites that will be flown later this year will give much more accurate data. But you can ask the question, well, what is the present situation? So this is what you do is you take objects you know about. For example, the Crab Nebula I showed you is an upper limit on the temperature. There's various upper limits on pulsars, how hot they can be. Very few of these are there really good measurements. But it doesn't have a name, it only has a telephone. And so from this, you can ask the question, do the cooling measurements actually require having accelerated cooling, or are they consistent with the ordinary measurements? The answer, as you can see from this picture, is quite inconclusive. There's nothing, if you found neutron stars from down here in this accelerated cooling regime, you'd say, well, this must be evidence of some unusual state, which could be. It goes on to condensate in these heavenly bodies. And so the answer here, I think we just have to wait and see.
At the moment, everything is consistent with accelerated, with normal cooling mechanism. But we really, at this stage, just don't know.
Well, I think at this stage, I've worn myself out, not you. And just trying to give you an overview of the fact that the Bose-Einstein condensation really is quite alive in the rest of the universe as well as in atomic drops. Thank you. That's probably left some out.
Can you comment on whether it was just in a laser that
Yeah. They are bosons. They are bosons, that kind they're not thermal. Are they thermal? I'm sure whatever I say, the quantum electronics people are going to yell at me. But let me just propose an interesting question. Should Marconi have won the Nobel Prize for inventing the laser? I mean, you know, our ordinary radio station is also photon. Our ordinary radio signal is also photon. There's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Age in years, yes. Okay, I should mention that. How do you know?
Yeah,
no, that's a very good question. If you look at this picture here, and let me actually turn it this way because it's easy to read. There's the Tycho saw supernova. That was in 1584. There's supernova 1006. These are old stars of supernova. You know exactly how old they are. Kepler, we actually didn't see. Kepler the Crab was July 4th, 1054. Again, from the size of the supernova remnant of age. The pulsars you don't quite know, but you get an estimate from the rate at which they're slowing down how old they are. And so these are all in the order of million, 10 million years. It's slow.
Yeah.
No, it's not the orbital parameters. What you measure is the rate at which they pulse. You know, the picture is you just have a beam going around. And so you look at the pulse repetition frequency. And that slows down with time. And the rate of slowing down gives you a measure of the age. It's a complicated argument.
It's more a semantic comment, but as Tony pointed out, we might maybe occasionally talk about semantics, especially together. I have some problems with saying that photons both condense. When people ask me, do photons both condense via bosons? We all know when we take a black body cavity and cool it down, at T equals zero, the black body cavity is empty. So the question is, do we want to use the word Bose-Einstein condensation for anything which has to do with bosonic stimulation and accumulation of bosons in the same quantum state, or do we want to reserve Bose-Einstein condensation with something which is related to equilibrium?
I think that's fair. I mean, that's the reason in my initial list I did not include the laser, despite Eric's question. One man's conserved is another man's not conserved. I mean, suppose protons decay. Rubidium decays.
I think if you re-thermalize a batch of photons by constant scattering, and so you preserve the number of photons, and somehow, probably numbers shouldn't play a role now, but and somehow you thermalize a gas of photons and preserve the photon number, it would pose something. But if you have been a cavity, it doesn't. And if you have it in a laser, laser is a driven system far away from thermal equilibrium. So one could take this as a distinguishing line, but it's semantic.
The parameter is the height of my finger above the button.
How do you find out the
Yeah. In fact, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is very curious. This Friday afternoon, we could relax. There's this very strange disjunction. You know, you learn about electrodynamics out of Jackson with its classical field. Then the next course you take is quantum electrodynamics, known as photon. How do you connect this?
I think that it was a kind of solution. Phenomena which happened at a fine temperature, macroscopical feeling of one temperature. When temperature is fine, if it's is something which give us was a condensation. If temperature is zero, and there will be macroscopical feelings of the level, it's nothing, in my opinion.
So you would say the Higgs is not a Bose condensation?
At least it's not necessary to discuss.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure, but I mean, it's the vacuum part that's important. That's why we weigh too much when we stand on scales. Okay. Well, I have a question. Really just a comment, which is one of the privileges of being the last speaker is to thank the organizers.